You remember we ended last time on in talking about the clinical language and its effects, the possible effects upon the people who use it. I was trying to make the point that because we have this language and we have developed it so richly, we tend to use it, I think, too much, a little too hastily, especially the diagnostic parts of it. We were talking about the use of terms like brain damage and aphasia and emotionally disturbed, when very often what we were dealing with were children who had simply learned to keep their mouths shut because they had been negatively reinforced when they talked. And so they had learned not to talk. And as you establish good relationship with them, that is to say, after they've received enough rewards or positive reinforcement for their attempts to respond verbally, as they find that it pays to do this, they talk. And so one can only conclude in many, many such cases, there is no brain damage. There is nothing that deserves the name of emotional disturbance with a heavy psychiatric accent. We tend to overlook the things that we can learn to do, which look bizarre sometimes, but which do not connote, do not symptomatize, do not indicate any pathology. But the clinical language is designed to talk about pathology, and so we use it, having learned it. And I think that we tend to exaggerate a great deal and make many statements that are not very valid and that tend to be harmful. I feel this deeply, and partly the reason I do it, I'm going to tell you about something. I told you at the end of the hour to remind me of my father. I'm going to tell you about something, partly because I think it is an interesting case or example, and partly to explain why I feel this so deeply. When I was a little boy, my father one day got run over by horses in a wagon, and his head was pretty badly smashed up. The bones of the head were broken. And an old doctor came out from the county seat town, lay him on the kitchen table. The neighbors came and threw water on the windows, which were covered with sheets to keep the air cool. And the old doctor proceeded to lay back the skull. He sawed it off, put it back, and took out a cup full of something. He took out bone splinters, brain tissue, blood, took out a cup full, put the head back on, the skull back on, and my father was unconscious for a week, but he recovered, and for 30 years after that, carried on a business that was pretty elaborate. He read a great deal, talked a great deal. It was a very interesting talk. I couldn't tell that there was any brain damage, but then I hadn't known him too well before this happened. But I later talked to a lot of individuals who had. I could get no evidence that this injury had made any difference. So the child comes into the clinic and you say brain damage. What have you said? You see, my father was brain damaged. Does this word mean anything in particular? I suspect we're all brain damaged. I doubt whether you can get born without being brain damaged. If you mean by brain damage that tissues of the brain are abused, they bleed, they're squashed a little. I think everybody is brain damaged. What do you mean brain damaged? But people in a clinic get very excited over this. They use the word brain damage and then they think they have said something very specific and very dire. I imagine that you've done business and probably have been taught courses by brain damaged people. I have friends who have been mentally ill. They've had such horrendous labels applied to them as schizophrenic. They're among my finest friends. If you have a functional point of view and you see what stares you in the face, you can only conclude that if the label ever did mean anything, and you can't be positive that it did, doesn't anymore, it's terribly healthy to use a very descriptive language and to use these diagnostic clinical terms with a very lively sensitivity of what they mean on the descriptive level, if anything, and of the limitations of their meaning. Well, we could talk all afternoon about individuals who have been diagnosed in one way or another by people who had learned some kind of clinical language with which to diagnose them. Some of the ones I could tell you about are very dramatic. They're living demonstrations of how little these words can sometimes mean. Now, I have another note here which reminds me to say something before I get on with the discussion of this very peculiar human interaction pattern that we call counseling. Are you warm? Open windows if you are, please. If you can stand to be by an open window. I want to talk about counseling this time and next time, pretty much. And as I do, I want you to be considering and try to keep in focus the matter of the degree and the ways in which you can apply these counseling principles in your own day-to-day and hour-to-hour relationships. These lectures are entitled Clinical General Semantics. I'm trying to reinterpret the word clinical for you so that you won't be making such a dichotomy between what people do in clinics and what they do in daily life, because some of the very finest human behavior has been developed in clinics. And it's high time we started behaving outside of clinics the way we behave in clinics, I think. Before I develop this, there's a note here. It reminds me to, I suppose, to scout you to see if you reacted to the exam last week in a certain way. I've heard a rumor and I've had a comment or two, in fact two or three of them, to the effect that this exam, that there wasn't time to answer this exam very adequately. How many would agree with this? Take a look around. Everybody says Almost, that's almost everybody, I guess. And one student also said that it would have been good to have had more time to get ready or to organize the answer. How many would agree? Almost as many, not quite. I'd like to talk with you about this a little bit. And first I want to agree with you that if you are going to think in any kind of, well, not idealistic even, but relatively high-level terms, an hour is, actually 50 minutes, is a very small amount of time to write anything that's very significant. That's the amount of time that is allowed according to the way a university is run. Now, and it would be good to have time to outline a question to the kinds of answers that you were asked. I want to, let's say, I want to look with you at a fact of life. You don't very often have much time in life to exercise judgment. I want to make this course, as much like life as I can. And you're going to often have the experience of having the phone ring. You pick it up. Maybe it's long distance. I'll tell you one. This happens to me quite often. It will happen to you. It probably does now. It may not be long distance always, but they're important calls. And you're asked a question. Would be nice if you had 5 minutes to outline your answer and 45 minutes to give it. But telephone costs being what they are, you don't usually have much more than 3 minutes, and you make an answer. The other day at Purdue, I told you a little about this, didn't I? This old master's program. There were 12 of us. It was late at night. We had just arrived. There was a room in which we were, in which there were about 100 people, deans, staff members, students. One of the students was conducting the program, and I was startled to hear him say, "Now I'm going to call on each one of these 12 persons to take about 2 minutes and tell us his philosophy." He said, "I'll take him in alphabetical order." Well, the only guy whose name began with A hadn't arrived yet. There was someone whose name began with B, and I didn't think I'd be next, but I was. I had been listening to the person whose name began with B, who spoke for roughly 30 seconds. And so I found myself on my feet. And in about a minute, I gave my philosophy. It would have been pretty nice to have had 5 minutes to have organized my answer and maybe half hour or an hour or 3 hours to give it. This happens over and over again. And I think school should be like life. Now, Now, I want to say just one more thing about this. This course is designed to help you, so far as this might be possible, or even desirable, to cultivate whatever we mean by your own thinking. Now, you don't do your own thinking, you don't exercise your judgment the next week, or after you have got yourself ready. You exercise it right now. That's the only time you ever exercise it. The only time that is really important to you is the next tenth of a second. The last one's already history, as much as it ever will be. Chuck it away. It's history. Oh, look at it first if you want to, or later, but it's history. The moment after next isn't here yet, and what it's going to be like will depend on what you do with the next one coming up. The time you're going to have to give your answers is right now, all through life, right now. Even if you have 5 minutes to prepare, it's that next second that counts, and the next one, while you're preparing even. If you've got any judgment to exercise, there's only one time you'll ever exercise it, and that's immediately. Immediately. You have to be ready to answer the phone. And you don't answer it by saying, "Pardon me, could you wait for 3 or 4 minutes while I get myself organized?" Someday, if it hasn't happened to you yet, someone's going to come along and ask you such an important question as, for instance, "Will you marry me?" And you're not going to say, "Probably." "Gosh, could you give me 20 minutes to organize my answer?" What did you want the time for? Now, let's go on with the lecture. But that's the question. Take it off to your mountaintop. What did you want the time for? Now let's talk about counseling. And I want to emphasize, I'm talking about a human relationship. Yeah, we're ready for the slides now, John. I'm talking about a human relationship. Maybe it would help to pull the shades on the windows that are not up, or down as far as you can pull them. And can you man the lights? Leave. No, wait a minute. Just the front. That ain't gotta work very well. I'm talking about human relationships. I'm talking about human problems. If I use the word clinical, or if the slides imply something clinical, this is quite incidental and is not to be emphasized. As I said, I think that the finest human behavior you find in clinics, there's no reason why we shouldn't try to transport it outside. As I said the other day, I want to remind you, the clinic is a place where we tend to set aside the usual rules of etiquette that obtain in the living room or at the dinner table. And we do ask the questions that are important. And we do answer in the ways that are important. We do behave sanely in a clinic. Well, what is it we do when we do this? And keep in focus. In what ways and to what degree can you do this anytime, anywhere? That's the only point of our talking about it here. What kind of problems generally do people have? Those of you who weren't here last time, I took some time to define what I mean by clinical in the context in which we're using it. We're not talking here mainly about medical, surgical problems, orthopedic problems, although we might be, depending upon what these mean to the person. But we're talking mainly about problems which are, we're talking about disability, but not disability as such, but what it means to you, how you live with it, how you think about it, and so forth. But we have problems. Some people have disabilities. They have missing arms, or they're deaf, and whatnot. There is something tangibly that they can point to and talk about. Others have behavior problems, as it were. They behave in some way that it appears to be significant to them or to others. The main kinds are evaluative. People feel. They have feelings, thoughts. They make evaluations that are somehow important to them or to others in their effects. We've already talked about the IFD pattern of behavior in this regard, from idealism to frustration to demoralization. And by disorientation in this context, I mean a very advanced stage of this sort of thing, where the person is so demoralized he really is not very much in touch with reality. You see this in some of the more grave kinds of mental disease, so-called. Let's have the next slide, John. Kinds of problems. These problems can be classified in various ways, and I think it helps us a little bit to get into focus. What kinds of problems do you have in your daily comings and goings and trying to get along with the people you're trying to get along with and trying to accept yourself, to live effectively in your world, your environment? Somatogenic, this term means problems caused by the meanings which you give to situations or facts about yourself or about other people. Interpretations which you make, and in terms of which you then act in ways which tend to make for trouble for you or for others. We talked about IFD problems. These problems, to break them down a little more, tend to involve anxiety tensions, the tensions which are related to anxieties, to the kinds of evaluations which we call anxiety, or worries, or fears. They involve language behavior in crucial ways. They do in clinics, they do in daily life. No particular difference between the problems you find in clinics and those you find in restaurants or bars or living rooms. So far as they are to be described in terms of language behavior. Reactions to school, what I'm thinking about here are really basically the interactions between teachers and pupils, teachers and students, and to some degree interactions between and among the students. But these problems are dealt with in rather specific terms as a rule, and I think to too great a degree, as though they were reading problems or difficulties with mathematics, so on. I think they are at bottom, to a large degree, problems which arise out of the interaction between teacher and student, or parent and child in preschool years, and even afterwards during school years. To a large degree, the problem stems from the negative reinforcement, from the behavior of the teacher who feels it is her mission to point out all the mistakes that the pupils make. And so they try to learn, and they are disapproved for their effort, and so they learn not to learn. And of course, it's so pathetic because the teacher thinks she's conscientious. There are parents like this. There are employers like this. A foreman, so on. I just called them school reactions here, and I mean all these things. The reactions people make to that relationship between a teacher or an instructor and students. Status problems. As you try to interact effectively with people in clinics, you become highly aware that people worry a good deal about their status, about how they are regarded, about how they compare, how they rate. But then if you're at all observant, you observe that this is also true of people outside of clinics. It is a rather general kind of problem people have. Let's have the next slide, please, John. Who has problems? Who comes to clinics? Who are the counselees? Well, in the kind of clinic that I'm familiar with, we sometimes get children without adults. I mean, we work directly with the children. We work with adults, and so we have that kind of a division. And these kinds of people are found outside of clinics too, of course. We have parents as a kind of special category of people who come with problems, as parents, as such, problems as parents. I don't think the problems they bring to clinics are especially different from those that they have as parents outside clinics. Teachers have problems. We counsel teachers. But the problems we counsel them about are probably no different in general from those they have for which they get no counsel. Next slide, please. What kinds of relationships, what kinds of methods, and can these be adapted? Well, they break down into these kinds, pretty much. You have group and individual relationships. And the group therapies, or the group counseling, or whatever you want to call it, tend to be of two kinds. That is, there's a continuum along which you can distribute them, from those that are highly structured, like a lecture or a singing lesson, to those that are very unstructured, as in the more extreme forms of role-playing therapy, the Marino type therapy, where you act out some situation, but it is not, there's a minimal kind of structuring to it. And then these can be something very much like the bull session. I think there is far more of whatever we seem to mean by therapy that goes on in dormitories and in clinics, in bull sessions. This is group therapy. And some of the best, it's hard to get any that good in a clinic. That is of the best, bull sessions. The individual relationship tends to be fairly well described in terms such as directive and non-directive. Again, we're dealing with a continuum along which these relationships can be distributed. But you have everything from the highly directive relationship in which the counselor gives advice and information or writes prescriptions to the kind in which there is none of this. The counselor is above all a listener, and he is a kind of eavesdropper who lets the counselee, the other person, talk to himself freely in a very non-directive way, as non-directive as one can be. There's a limit to how non-directive you can be, of course. Next one, please. How does a counselor function? What does he do? And do you do this with your friends? And to what degree? And in what ways should you not, you think? And so on. He's an investigator. He tries to find out what the facts are, if there's a problem. This is where etiquette tends to get in the way. Etiquette. It isn't always good manners. It's hardly ever good manners to be an investigator. Counselor can serve as a confidant. Well, you can do this. In fact, you can do it better than most professional clinicians can do it for their clients. At least you can do it for a few people, for one or two, perhaps. This relationship in the counseling situation is a rather unique one, distinctive. It's not quite like friendship. It's not quite like love and marriage. It's not just an acquaintanceship. It's not the relation of the buyer and the seller, and so on. But it has many aspects to it that I think we could cultivate much more than we do in our daily life relationships. And that of the confidant, I think, is one of these, especially between very close friends, or between man and wife, and to a higher degree than we do as a rule between parent and child and teacher and student. I think we tend to block communication in these relationships much more than would seem at all to be necessary, and the word necessary sort of stops me there. Desirable. You, as a counselor, you serve as a sort of a semantic mirror. You hold up to the other person what he has said and help him to see more clearly what he has said, to understand the meaning of it, or what the meanings might be. Incidentally, the tape recorder is one of the most powerful instruments that you could imagine for this. And the counselor becomes, I think, if he's at all effective, becomes very skillful in the use of the tape recorder It's to him what the knife is to the surgeon. It's just, I think, if you're going to work at this with the most effectiveness, you just have to master the tape recorder. And I say master advisedly. This isn't something you just turn on and let run and turn off again. You play this instrument. You do things with it that are calculated to enable the individual to get as good a reflection as he can get of his semantic self. Some counselors do this to some degree, in the way that the Carl Rogers has made popular. He calls it reflecting, or he says back to the patient, or the client, as he would call him, what the person says. So you think you'd like to shoot your mother. Huh? I see. Well, that's a kind of exaggerated example, but this is the idea. So you feel that you haven't had a chance, really, to develop your abilities in this situation. That's how you feel. You know, so there's a good deal of this reflecting in some of the counseling relationships. To some degree, this can be applied very well, I think, in ordinary relationships. It's almost a courtesy. It's a way to let the other person know that you have paid attention to what he said and you're trying to understand it. I see. You mean that you feel, etc. It takes a good deal of perceptiveness to do it without interfering with the relationship. The counselor, I think the word eavesdropper points up almost more than any other word what a counselor does. The other person is not really talking to him. The other person is talking to himself. The counselor is an eavesdropper, but he's a skillful eavesdropper. He's a kind of eavesdropper that keeps the other person talking to himself and as effectively as possible. Calling it this may sort of interfere with your thinking of ways to apply this principle in your ordinary relationships, but I certainly think that this is part of a good relationship. The ability, that is, to submerge your own need to express yourself. Put it aside. Let the other person express herself or himself. And you be attentive to it. And as though you appreciated the other person's need to really explore with himself or herself his feelings, wonderings, and don't interfere. Just be a good eavesdropper. Let's have the next line. The counselor is a question supplier, and this, I think, is a very subtle and important distinction between the word questioner or question asker and question supplier. A good eavesdropper supplies questions for the person to answer, to ask himself an answer for himself. You see, what I'm trying to point up is that when I, as a counselor, ask the other person a question, I don't want the answer. The answer is not primarily for me. the answer is primarily for the other person. I'm not asking the question, I'm supplying it in order to facilitate the self-communication of the other person. And I think there's a good deal of this that enters into any very good relationship outside a clinic. You don't demand answers of your friends. You're interested enough to wonder how they would answer to themselves, or you'd like to be helpful. Have you ever thought of, and so forth. A consultant, I guess, is a person who is asked for help about specific things. You're consulted about a problem. And I suppose we all learn fairly fast not to be voluntary consultants. People are often startled to have us suddenly begin operating in the role of a consultant to them when they hadn't called us. I do think that it is highly desirable not to resent consultants, self-appointed consultants. You sometimes learn a great deal from them. You get a lot of advice free that can be helpful. And it is really, I think, very foolish to resent it. But it can make for moments of awkwardness to offer it. You do sometimes have to serve as an instructor in a clinical situation to show someone how to do something. We do a good deal of this in our ordinary relationships. The important thing is to do it graciously, effectively, is probably the better word. Sometimes you are called upon, or I should almost say you are always to some degree, whether you like it or not, and whether the other person consciously means to put you in that position or not, you have to fill the role of an authority figure in a clinical situation, our culture being what it is, our social history being what it is. Most of us grow up with some kind of a tendency to transfer to people who are something like our mothers and fathers the attitude that to them that they are authority figures. And so we react toward teachers and doctors and priests and lawyers and judges, policemen and so forth, in ways somewhat like the ways in which we react to our mothers and fathers, as though they were authority figures. And I think one of the greatest problems that a professional clinician has is to try, in all the ways he can, to keep the person from doing it. Now, I know this runs entirely counter to the teaching that you would get in many medical schools or other kinds of professional training institutions, where you are taught to play the role of an authority figure. Well, I think it tends to be bad for the person who plays it. It tends to make him develop an grossly exaggerated notion of his own wisdom, his own importance. And I think that it's bad for the people who react to this behavior on his part, because it tends to make them feel too much like children, too irresponsible. And so it constitutes a problem for all of us to deal with this tendency we have to react to people as though they were authority figures or to be authority figures. We got time for one more, I think, Joan. What kinds of relationship do you find in a counseling situation? And again, ask yourself, are these reflected in your own relationships outside the clinic? And you find, as you observe the counselor-counseling relationships, they might be warm, empathic. The counselor is trying to feel like the other person, to see the world through his eyes, and so forth. And I'm going to assume that you know what warm means. If you don't, it would be hard to tell you. I'll use that as first order undefined term today. Observing. Some counselors are very observing, and they encourage observing behavior on the part of the other person. They are understanding in some instances. This doesn't mean they understand necessarily, but they're understanding. They're working at it. They're trying to be understanding. Evaluative. This has many meanings. Advisory. These are all kinds of relationships, modes of relationship. And I think they define not only the relationships within clinics, but those outside as well. Let's see the next slide and see what we're leaving off with. What is the effect of this kind of relationship we've been talking about? What can be the effect? We'll start there next time.